Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
Welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show. Today, Thursday, the 25th of April, with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick. Last year, we heard a lot about West Africa and the coups in Niger, amongst other places. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Blake Lovewell, who's been doing a deep dive into exactly what's going on in the Sahel region over the last few months. It dominated the headlines until, of course, events in the Middle East and Ukraine overtook it. We've learned today that Burkina Faso's military summarily executed 223 civilians, including at least 56 children, in a single day in late February, according to an investigation into one of the worst abuses by the country's armed forces for years. Mass killings have been linked to a widening military campaign to tackle jihadist violence and happened weeks after Russian troops landed in the country to improve security. As I say, joining me now is Blake Lovewell. That's Burkina Faso, Blake. Have similar things been happening in Niger, or has it all settled down there now?
I would say hello, firstly. Good to be with you. And settled down is very far from the state of affairs in West Africa right now. I haven't seen reports of massacres taking place in Niger. I'll be using the French pronunciation, as Niger is part of the Francophone West African community. There are various different pronunciations, and for specificity's sake, Niger is the country just to the north of Nigeria. But you know, these state borders have all been drawn up by the colonial masters beforehand, so they're not as true to the situations on the ground. So Niger, Mali and Burkina Faso all kind of share a kind of common heritage, and there are various different tribes and groups that straddle the borders, including down into Nigeria. So we can look at those as a group of states on a very similar trajectory. Both Burkina Faso and Niger have had their military coups, taking over power from the governments last year in 2023. Mohamed Bassoum, the president of Niger for 2 years after being elected in 21, he was overthrown by the military, and the military have taken over. And then in the ensuing 6 or 7 months, we've seen some vying for power, some, as the dust settles, because let us not forget, there have been seven overt large-scale military coups in West Africa in the last 3 years. Not only Burkina Faso, but many other states have seen regime change. To your question, there haven't been massive massacres reported. There has been small-scale violence, and there is definitely turbulence in the region. The reports on the Burkina Faso massacre, you can call it that because civilians and children were killed. But it's actually very hard to pin down what's going on here, because there is a large amount of terrorism, a broad catch-all word that we've gotten used to just throwing off the bat, terrorism. But groups that use military force that are not the officially designated military, they also use fear and have no regard for, international law on conflicts. We can more closely designate them if we use the moniker Boko Haram, as well as Boko Haram affiliates. This region is kind of, I wouldn't say dominated, but I would say it is heavily infiltrated by Boko Haram. And that is probably the biggest problem in the state, and therefore the cause for regime change by and large. Boko Haram harass civilian populations. They also harass state forces here and there. I am also going to state that I'm skeptical of Boko Haram being a monolithic entity, a kind of an organic growth of a rebellion in Islamic countries. Mali is predominantly Muslim, and there are minority Muslim groups throughout the region. But to state that their Boko Haram's rise has been a natural outgrowth of, you know, say, poor economic conditions, and people turn to the radical side of things. I think that narrative, you know, that we've been fed in the West of disgruntled Afghanis, you know, grouping together and deciding to take down America and so on. I think we've kind of seen that narrative through and realized that often the Mujahideen converted to the Al-Qaeda and then to ISIS was much more a creation of the American intelligence state, as well as the UK and many other imperial or post-colonial powers. We also must point the finger somewhat at the French, as Niger is one of a large group of West African states that still depend on France, despite in August 1960, Niger having become independent of the French colonial power. They've gone through successive coups, and France still retains, you know, still has its tentacles attached, I would say, particularly using the West African franc, which is the currency that the West African countries depend on. That is actually distributed from France. So France has a large say over the economic policies of these countries. Kind of side tangent there.
I could just jump in there. I think it was one of the Rothschild who said, if I can control a country's currency, I care not who makes its laws. That is paraphrasing, of course, and I don't want to misattribute that claim, but I didn't know that France still runs the Nigerian currency.
Mm. Yes, it's a very Rothschildian policy, isn't it, to control the currency and therefore control the people. And we could take a large tangent there, but I think the viewers and listeners are getting some useful information about West Africa, which is somewhere that you kind of, it pops up as the third or fourth story maybe in the mainstream media, and you say, oh, I guess Burkina Faso's having trouble again, you know, well, that African state.
It was the top story for a while last summer when I was presenting the Compass program here on Today's News Talk, and we went all around the world, and I found myself talking a lot about ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States,
indeed,
who authorized military intervention in Niger on the 10th of August. They then met again on the 17th and 18th and decided on a D-Day if diplomatic solutions fail. There was no military intervention. So does that mean that the diplomatic solutions succeeded, or that everybody just thought the stakes were too high?
My opinion is that, well, diplomacy has had some success in West Africa, but I would say lots of what's going on now is back-channel diplomacy. We're not seeing overt statements of clear intent. We're seeing lots of post-event attribution of blame or so on and so forth. ECOWAS, the group you referred to earlier there, is kind of Africa's failed answer to the EU. Well, let us not forget that it was Muammar Gaddafi in Libya who tried to, or one was one of the fathers of the African Union, the AU, who still exist alongside ECOWAS as the kind of African international institutions. But in Africa, they've been neutered. They have no claws, and they serve much more as a talking house. And I would say, controversially, or perhaps not, they serve as a vessel for Western states to still control Africa, but still have, you know, the kind of African flag attached to the front of it and African staff. So it doesn't seem so imperial as previously. Now, that was last August, ECOWAS kind of said they were going to do a military intervention, then pulled back from that. In the last couple of weeks, they've also said that they wish to put boots on the ground. And ECOWAS does have a very small contingent of peacekeeping troops. I'm using very large air quotes there, because what we mean by peacekeeping and troops, you know, they're kind of antithetical. But ECOWAS has been, asked by, some powers, perhaps Western powers, perhaps other powers, to come in and broker deals and do some peacemaking. But they're not very welcome in Niger. I believe that the currency that they use, the street cred, is very low. ECOWAS mired in various small-scale scandals, which don't really percolate up to the large international news sphere, but they definitely have an impact on the ground. And I think that even groups like the UN or large NGOs, charities, aren't very well trusted. And so ECOWAS, given they don't have a lot of political currency, as well as popularity on the ground, they haven't found such success in trying to establish themselves. And that is one of many areas in which I believe that Western, by that I mean the axis of the US, UK and their allies, efforts to control West Africa are failing over and over for the last few years. And lots of these coups have fallen under the remit of the Russia slash China block of power, if we're looking at the world in this kind of post United States hegemony, that being that the United States has fallen from its perch as number one. There are various challenges in the Middle East, in Eastern Europe, and all over the world against its hegemony. The same is happening in West Africa, where in Niger in particular, the US troops in the last week have been asked to leave. Now, there was a military coup 7 months ago, and it was thought that the US troops would be allowed to stay. However, the US, the Nigerian military has been courting Russia and has been doing deals with Russia. They now have air defense systems from Russia, as well as training to use them. And they have Russian military training of the Nigerian army. Now, that is one step below what the US did. What the US did was move into Niger. They built a $100 million air base, which they could fly their high-tech drones all over West Africa. You'd think with a $100 million air base and high-tech drones, they could take out Boko Haram, which are this kind of piecemeal beatnik operation of jihadi terrorists that kind of roam West Africa. But I would argue that it's in the US's interest to keep Boko Haram harassing everybody around there to maintain instability. And then the US can be this, sort of hegemonic mafia leader, the least of all the evils. But Niger had been given a better offer by Russia, and Russia don't want to build a base. They don't want to station Russian troops there, but they will give the Nigerian army training, assets and resources to fight off any enemies which they see fit. We must hope that a military junta does somewhat have some answer to the people of these nations, because the illusion of democracy in West Africa has truly fallen, and we're back to the strongman military coup. Sometimes in the cycle they go towards democracy and have elections, but then the elected official is more corrupt than the military government that led before, and we're back to the military government now, definitely in multiple states right now. But I believe Russia is making a good deal. They are giving a good offer to these states for training, resources, as well as that they're falling in line with the, I called it the Russia-China bloc, because China works through economic and trade power rather than military might. So in this sense, we can see Russia doing the military and China doing the trade. they're providing infrastructure like roads and so on and so forth. And this is not before anybody accuses me of being pro-Russia or pro-China bloc, I'm trying to stay neutral on both. It's not because out of the goodwill of their Russian and Chinese hearts, it is because of the massive natural resources in West Africa. Niger, one of the biggest sources of raw uranium, has huge deposits of iron, some of the most wealthy diamond mines, and so on and so forth. These states are extremely resource rich, but extremely financially poor. And so having good deals for Russia and China, it's a very good deal to tie in with these nations and look like the good guy, because then later down the line, you're going to get some good deals on your uranium. And let us not forget, too, most of these global conflicts now, I believe, are to do with rare earth metals, those precious substances that go into microchips and high technology fields that are going to be so contentious once those resources become more and more scarce, particularly for military and other superpower type endeavors. They're going to need these rare earth metals.
We're going to take a short break now with the network. When we come back, I'll be asking Blake about the Alliance of Sahel States, a belt of countries allied to Niger that lies to the north of the ECOWAS countries, and the possibility of armed conflict between the two. We'll be right back after this short break.
TNT's Lembit Open.
I am always disappointed when I see civil servants, and he was a civil servant, he wasn't elected, preaching to the elected representatives of this country about what they should and shouldn't be doing. I wonder what his next job's going to be. Will it be in the Green movement or somewhere else? Fundamentally, my issue is that Chris Stark assumes that everybody agrees that there is a climate emergency. And even more strangely, he thinks it's good for the British economy for us to invest in stopping this climate emergency.
Limit. OPEC. And today's news talk, TNT. Today's news talk.
News and information.
TNT Radio.
And welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show with me, Basil Valentine, in for Patrick today, Thursday, the 25th of April. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Blake Lovewell, investigative journalist and TNT contributor. And we're looking at a region that was all the news last summer, but has very quickly dropped down the schedules. That is West Africa. Niger, of course, had a coup, which apparently had the support of the majority of the ordinary population, who were out in the streets cheering afterwards at the deposing of a corrupt government. Not that that made any difference to the Western-backed powers of ECOWAS, but the ECOWAS countries are a belt to the south. All of them enjoy a coast on the Atlantic Ocean. Niger is one of a number of landlocked countries to the north who collectively form the Alliance of Sahel States. And it looked for a while, with those countries increasingly coming under Russian influence, of the possibility of a second front in the Ukraine-Russian war, believably or not, in East Africa. Has the possibility of armed conflict now receded permanently, Blake?
No, not at all. I would say that, I mean, making predictions in politics is kind of a fool's errand, because there's always something coming out of left field that you can't predict. But predicting the end of violent conflict would be a fool's errand. I would say that what we're going to see is some stabilization, as it right now in Niger. There are Russian and US troops. The US troops are doing the end of the Vietnam scramble for the last helicopter out of the country. The Russian troops are doing the most diplomatic, least bellicose, least warmongering that they can do whilst still, you know, taking over the reins of the Nigerian military apparatus. So what we're seeing is it's a kind of stalemate. If you're looking at a chess match, I would say that it's in very awkward territory, but the pieces haven't started being taken yet. We're still seeing fighting amongst the pawns, but we haven't seen the big powers moving. But as I mentioned just before the break, the sort of resource curse that these West African states have is that they have so much of these much sought after resources that they're going to see, unless they can really establish a strong state apparatus for defense of the kind of nation and the territory, not only that, the people as well as the resources, without any strong apparatus there, they're going to fall victim to bigger powers. And right now we can see Niger move flipping to the Russian side because simply the Russians are offering a better deal. I think that Russia operates in quite a diplomatic way with its allies, at least for the time being. They offer a kind of quid pro quo mutual assistance. And also, whilst I did mention the fall of the US from its hegemonic position, nobody wants to really openly come out against the US military. You can do it against the mercenary forces, you know, you can do it against Boko Haram, but if you're going to come out and attack US military, I mean, the only people successfully doing that are in the Middle East right now, and their success comes at a very high cost too. So I would say that it's a murky picture, but I think that Russia is offering some stability in the region. The US is pulling back, but as you see, it saw with the collapse of the Roman Empire, or with the collapse of any strong military and economic empire, things do get ugly because there's a scramble for the resources, there's a scramble to be the new head of the region, and so the possibility for armed conflict has not ceded. I also think that as this century might be the Chinese and Southeast Asian century, that the century after that will be the African century. Africa being a continent that is one of the most fertile, the most fecund continents on Earth. It's also got one of the highest birth rates, healthy, youthful population, very low C19 vaccination rate, but that's a story for another time. But it's also got tons of these resources, you know, uranium, rare earth metals, it's got diamonds, it's got whatever you want. Africa has got it. And if Africa can control it and stop the sort of external vampires from pillaging its resources, then I believe the 2100s will be the African century. And you can quote me on that in 150 years' time, because I won't be here to be proven wrong, or right or wrong. So I think that short term, we're going to see this piecemeal sort of toing and froing. I think that with the pulling back of the US over military operation, they will put more money and effort into the covert, which means Boko Haram, ISIS-like groups. I think there'll be... we've already tracked weapons, as I've reported on in my latest article, World War Grift, that most of the weapons that go to Ukraine are then exfiltrated into either the Middle East, but they also find their way through Egypt, through Turkey, into North Africa. And from there, they get spread amongst various different groups. But Boko Haram is one that has been reported to have received US arms that were sent to Ukraine, have ended up there.
So American taxpayers are directly providing the weapons, or indirectly, I should say, through various arms smugglers and nefarious channels for the terrorist troops that the United States claims to be fighting.
Yes, exactly. I don't believe that the US is fighting. You can find very scant reports that the US does anything very helpful against Boko Haram. And there are times where they have allied as well. But it's a very murky picture because it's not just good versus evil. It's kind of five different shades of evil all vying for power and control. And then, unfortunately, the sort of civilians, the regular folks who are just trying to get on with their lives, they get caught in the middle. And on a wider scale, they they see their nation or their economy being kept in the doldrums. Who does this benefit? The most important question, cui bono? Well, that benefits the people who are pillaging the resources. They can pay next to nothing for the raw resources. They're in a very unstable environment, so they can operate slave-like conditions, whether it's slavery or not. I mean, it's very close to slavery when it's like this. So who's benefiting? There's massive corporations, and some of the biggest mining corporations in Africa are actually Canadian. There's also massive mining corporations out of Australia. So it's not really just US bad. It's kind of all against all, and I would say it's really the grounds for geopolitics, that being the real politic, the politics that's based on resources. It's based on military might, as compared to the normative politics of the kind of modern Western ideology, where maybe in the EU, where everything's talking about norms and trade deals and moral judgments and so on and so forth. It's interesting, as time goes on, you think that you might think that we're kind of developing the kind of illusion of Western development, from less economically developed to more economically development, leads to more democracy and so on and so forth. But we're seeing a resurgence in geopolitics, which is, military conflicts. We're seeing resource wars and so on and so forth. And so I don't believe there is this correlation as time goes on that things get better. I think it requires a sustained effort of lots of different people working at lots of different levels, including us, to inform you or anybody out there listening who picks up some of these tidbits and decides to research that and spread, promulgate the message. All of that goes towards, what we hope for, which is peace. I do predict that Africa will rise. It doesn't need Western assistance. It would probably like as little Western assistance as possible.
Major General Pat Ryder held a press briefing today in which he said the United States is relocating most of the approximately 100 troops it has deployed in Chad until after the May 6th presidential election in that country, when they hope to bring them back. This is US AFRICOM, of course, who are also departing from Niger, where they've had 1,000 personnel. US and Nigerian officials are expected to meet in Niamey to initiate discussions on an orderly and responsible withdrawal of US forces. The French have already gone, haven't they? So isn't this an indicator of a gradually weakening Western position in Niger itself?
I would say that I did smirk there because you said the line reasonable and orderly. And as we know with politics, what they report as the headline is quite often the opposite of the truth. So I believe there's a lot of scurrying, a lot of panicking. And as I said, I would liken it to the last helicopter out of Saigon, because US have become more and more unpopular. Not only West Africa is not blind to what's happening in the Middle East with Israel either. If you were the man holding the whip, and then you turn your back and show weakness as you're walking away, in a weak position, you may well get jumped. And I think that the US is really seeking to do its nice and orderly withdrawal / panicked exit and rush away without seeing US troops killed. It doesn't mind if US proxy troops, the mercenaries, the people they fund and support, or the people, that they are involved with, it doesn't mind if they die. But if US troops die, that's a different kettle of fish. Kind of like, as I liken it to, in the Israel-Gaza conflict, it took 7 Western aid workers to kind of turn the tide, and now we're seeing the whole situation change. So if the US were to have troops killed in West Africa, then suddenly the US population, especially in an election year, would ask, why are there 1,000 US troops in Niger or 100 in Chad? What are they doing? And how come they haven't eradicated Boko Haram after about 15 years of their imperial endeavors there? And the answers to those questions, well, they lead straight back to the military-industrial complex. It doesn't take very many steps far from 6 degrees of separation. It's about 1 degree of separation to the military private contractors as well. But this is not just bashing on the US, because Russia have also had their private military corporations involved in West Africa for a long time, providing, you know, military support for the presidents or leaders or dictators or juntas, whichever you want to define them as, that Russia support. During some of these coups, there was, you know, bounce back, and it looked like the coup might have failed, but without Russian intervention. Russia hasn't sent its troops in. Well, they have in training roles, but they haven't in military roles, and likewise they don't want to be seen openly fighting in a sort of scramble for Africa too. Scramble for Africa, the phrase when the colonial powers all decided that it was terra nullis, and that they could chop it up like it were on the block at a marketplace. So perhaps this is the second scramble for Africa, where the Russia-China bloc or the BRICS or whatever they are versus the US and Western powers and France are vying for control of these nation states.
Yes, speaking of Russian mercenaries, the PMC Wagner of Yevgeny Prigozhin were supposedly operating in Niger, and Prigozhin himself supposedly spotted in West Africa after he was supposed to have died in that plane crash. But that's a conspiracy theory, isn't it, Blake? Finally, the junta in Niger were under tremendous pressure in the weeks after the coup. You know, they had to go. All the Western politicians and diplomats were saying, we can't allow this. This sort of got to go. We're going to sanction them into oblivion, even if we don't invade. But it seems like the Nigerian junta are quite firmly ensconced in power with many regional allies now, are they not?
Yes, they are, and ensconced is the perfect word. They've settled in, partly because, as I said, we've got seven other military coups in that region. So one coup backs another, and also they have a similar goals. So there's a natural alliance there. There's also an alliance between Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, which is not the aforementioned alliance of Sahel. This is its own alliance drawn up just in the last month or so to share this military prowess that Russia's bringing, and to try and bring about an end to the kind of terror reign of Boko Haram in the region. I think what you know, if fundamental causes, people want the end of Boko Haram by hook or by crook, so they're doing whatever they can in the region to do that. Now, what's keeping the Boko Haram up? I would say it's probably Western powers, in particular the US intelligence sphere, which is something that isn't really addressed, because we know that in the Middle East, the kind of ISIS, ISIL, you know, that is basically a US proxy. You know, they're in Iraq, they're harassing Syria, they're harassing Assad in Syria, you know. Wherever the US finds an enemy in the kind of on the shopping list from the Project for a New American Century, you'll also find ISIS, and you'll find that they aren't punished. Let us not forget that when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State in the US, she refused or blocked Boko Haram from being listed as a terrorist organization, even though they were pretty much an offshoot of the US created Al-Qaeda movement for a long while, until eventually, after a few years, that Boko Haram were finally designated a terrorist organization, and then it became a lot harder for the US to overtly support them, because there are actually laws in the US about openly funding and arming terrorist groups. But it was very handy to keep them under Hillary Clinton off the designated terrorist list for a few years whilst they were being fomented. I would say that despite there being laws against said funding, I believe it still goes on to a high degree, and that the powers of the West African states or the West African peoples to resist that must be extremely strong and heartfelt, because they don't have the same economic might, they don't have the same technological power, but they do have a spirit of resistance that hasn't been defeated yet.
Finally, Blake, Jamaat Nasser al-Islam wal-Muslimin. Bit of a mouthful. That's a support group for Islam and Muslims, claimed to be a militant jihadist organization operating in the Sahel region and formed by the merger of Ansar Dine, the Massina Liberation Front, Al-Murabitun, and the Saharan branch of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. They seem to control a phalanx of territory as well. It really is a patchwork quilt of competing factions, nations, and organizations, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And if you're not from that region, then it's not clear who those people answer to. So hopefully we've cleared that up a bit for people. I would hope so. You know, to simplify it, Boko Haram fall largely on the US side, but they have their own agenda. These kind of Al-Qaeda affiliates, similarly, and as I said, their arming comes through the same old CIA gun running technique. And then we've outlined as well the hopes for peace, even though it's military juntas taking over. We haven't seen as many of these rampant, acts against humanity that you mentioned right at the start in Burkina Faso. Those have been stymied and they aren't popular in the countries. The one rule of politics, you either run a really strict dictatorship, as Niger had in 1991, ended in 1991. They had 20 years of strong dictatorship, or you have something that's popular with the people. And they had about 6 years after that of populist politicians being elected. So hopefully we can have a kind of 6 years of peace. And the cessation of Boko Haram and so on. But given the resource curse, I think it's definitely going to keep simmering away. As I say, we hope for peace there.
Lovewell, investigative journalist and regular TNT contributor, thank you so much for joining us tonight on The Patrick Henningsen Show.
Great to be with you. See you again soon.
You will indeed. We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, I'll be joined by State of the Nation host Brian McLean for a look at what's happening on American campuses with the crackdown on anti-genocide protesters seemingly intensifying and what we can expect from his program later tonight.
Might not see it coming. It's prediabetes, and it captures 1 in 3 adults. You may not even know you have it, but you can escape. Take the 1-minute prediabetes risk test to know where you stand. With early diagnosis, you can change the outcome and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. Be your own hero on smartphones everywhere at doihaveprediabetes.org.
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is him. Every day he's hungry for something. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that he's a good person. I think the advice I would give is you don't need to know all the answers. It's okay to make mistakes. As long as it's coming from love, then it kind of starts to work itself out.
Political commentator and investigative journalist. You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick today, Thursday the 25th of April. Now, here on TNT, we like to decide what the news priorities are in the world and give you a very different view of events from that in the corporate media. And a startling example of that is I've just turned to the NBC News front page where the most important thing happening in America at the moment is the Supreme Court signaling further delays in Trump election interference case as it weighs the president's immunity, with Mitch McConnell saying presidents should not be immune from prosecution. Meanwhile, witness at hush money trial details deals with Playboy model and porn actress to protect Donald Trump. At least if he wins, I will be pardoned for electoral fraud. Tabloid editor's text read at Trump trial. You wouldn't know that there was a revolution underway on college campuses. But if you ask me, from what I'm seeing on social media, which is where you get the real news these days, we've got absolutely unprecedented scenes going as far as the head of the philosophy department at Emory University in Georgia being arrested for protesting an elderly lady. Absolutely extraordinary stuff. Joining me now to discuss this and other American news is host of State of the Nation, Brian McLean. Great that you can join me, Brian.
Hey, it's great to see you, Basil. Thanks for having me today. Isn't it amazing how much media gas goes into the power politics when all this is breaking in the background?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this is surely the most significant, widespread protests on college campuses since the Vietnam War. In fact, I would say that there are more and bigger protests going on now. If I can just go through the live updates. Columbia increases patrol ahead of counter-protests outside of campuses. 46 University of Texas Austin protest cases dismissed by a prosecutor for legal concerns. University of Pennsylvania students have begun an encampment just tonight. There's no deadline, it's timeline, Colombian students say of negotiations. Pro-Palestinian protests continue to grow at campuses in New York and Texas. And we've got a clip of what happened at the University of Texas Austin, not very far, I believe, from where you're based, Hesha. If we could play that clip too now. I believe that some of the cops were on horseback. Elsewhere, further east, we've seen. Elsewhere, further east, we've seen sort of Robocop-style police with full riot shield and batons and all the rest of it, you know, directly confronting protesters. Is it fair to say, Hesha, that if this was about anything other than objecting to Israel's Gaza in genocide, we would not see anything like this degree of heavy-handedness by the authorities?
We just don't have to look backwards very far to see a whole bunch of protests, you know, starting in the Trump era, related to not just, Trump and there's always this control over the narrative too, right? Like during the sort of, Antifa riots against Trump, it was all calling him fascist and stuff like this, but you never saw a police response like that. Very rare to see a police response like that. One could argue maybe you saw something similar in Charlottesville, but again, a highly stage managed event, highly media centric event with a lot of dubious characters there. We talked yesterday about how certain scenes that are being shown in the media are very similar to that right now. But this is certainly getting beyond the realms of expectation, perhaps by some. It's a large amounts of students, and it is spreading across the nation, just like we said it would yesterday.
I think the comparison with the aftermath of the George Floyd business is particularly prescient.
Yes.
Enormously violent protests, looting, number of people killed, shops burnt to the ground, really very, very high level of violence and criminal damage. And yet, the talking heads on MSNBC and the corporate media were doing everything they could to downplay it. Mostly peaceful protests, righteous anger, and all the rest of it we heard. Even though we could see with our own eyes that it was anything but. Contrast that with what's going on now, where you have genuinely peaceful protests, students holding hands and singing rainbow songs, drumming and dancing and making speeches, and yet they are met with state violence. What's that all about? Try and make it make sense for me. It's all, of course, about what the cause is. It suited the Zionist liberal establishment to bash the police. It doesn't suit the Zionist liberal establishment for there to be any genuine solidarity with the people of Palestine.
Yeah, and then ironically, all of a sudden, there's no shortage of police. Isn't that interesting? The very police that they were, you know, victimizing, essentially demonizing during George Floyd, they're now calling in to go after students. You know, there were dozens arrested in Austin between last night and yesterday, and you know, they're out there to protest against a country that is bombing schools. So they're blocking the entrances to schools, perhaps, or using their free speech in front of schools while schools have been bombed in Gaza. Isn't that amazing?
Oh, it's an absolute joke. That's right. There are sort of squeals on social media about how awful it is that university life is being disrupted. Compare and contrast with the universities being demolished, you know, controlled explosive or uncontrolled explosive demolitions of universities and places of higher education across Gaza, as well as the summary execution of innumerable Gazan academics, because there has been a concerted attempt to wipe out the intelligentsia of Gaza in amongst the massacres. Of course, the only fig leaf that they've got to try and demonize these protesters is to accuse them all of anti-Semitism, as if somehow suddenly hundreds of students, including many Jewish students and indeed members of faculty at Columbia and elsewhere, have suddenly decided, have suddenly developed this intense hatred of all Jewish people for no reason at all. And it's that hatred of Jewish people that is causing them to demonstrate on behalf of terrorists, Hamas, because anybody objecting to Hamas, objecting to genocide, apparently supports Hamas. I mean, it's so idiotic, it's so childish, it's so pathetic, you know, but it's what gets repeated in the media. Go on.
Well, one of the worst things that you can be told in a identity politic is that you're in a dialectic whether you like it or not. There's no room for nuance whatsoever. You're either, it's like a George Bushian, right? You're either with us or you're with the terrorists, you know. No room for us to talk about things, how there are Christian churches that have been blown up in Gaza, and you know, how many Jewish people live in Iran, for example, and just how catastrophic the plans of the war pigs are for, you know, all types of people in all of the locations that are affected. There's just no allowance for that. It's like coming to America and being from Africa or something, and only having heard about it and saying, oh, it's a Christian nation, right? And expecting you get there and everybody's, you know, doing the same Christian activities. That's not how countries work. So people seem to think that Israel is somehow benevolent. I don't understand this, because we're all pretty aware of the machinations of the deep state, of globalism, of United Nations plans and WEF plans and all this. And to somehow, you know, all be able to link up on, you know, agreeing about that, and then this happens, and all of a sudden Israel is not part of the deep state. You know, these are just, I do not understand how people can not see.
Well,
that.
I mean, I think it's actually very sinister. You know, Netanyahu a couple of days ago started talking about how American campuses are resembling Germany in 1938 or something. It's deliberately mendacious, really. It's this endless conflation of any criticism of Israel, even when committing genocide, even when massacring babies, children and civilian is somehow anti-Semitic and means you want to go back to reenacting the Holocaust or something. It's fundamentally dishonest. That's the point. And unfortunately, it's repeated by the corporate media. The possibility of the existence of anti-Zionist Jewish people is one that's completely discounted. And it's one that's ignored by the media as well.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of Jewish students, you know, wearing T-shirts, you know, saying, I am Jewish, Jews against genocide. Particularly around the New York area, big young Jews against genocide movement, completely ignored, never platformed in the mainstream media. You'll never right. get anybody from Jews against genocide on MSNBC.
You would think you should see someone from MSNBC looking to be the scoop, be the first person to get that microphone yes. with the MSNBC foamy on it into some kid's face that most people haven't seen yet, saying something that's not being said by your competitors in the media. But no. Nothing like that. It's like that doesn't exist. And then we're shown all the footage that's prepackaged, that's stage managed, that has NGO people from white buses involved in it being, you know, ridiculous. And then saying that that represents all of these people. Well, it doesn't. And I got news for you. In colleges, we just spent the last, I don't know how many years, getting them very, very tuned up about looking for people that are being marginalized. And the way that they perceive that is evolving right now as they get a little bit older. And this isn't going to go away anytime soon. This is irreparable damage to the reputation of globalism on whole, because they see that Israel is part of globalism on whole. And it's also, isn't it ironic, Basil, that now people, young people that are ostensibly leftist are being called Nazis and fascists, just like young people on the right were called for the last decade or so.
Purely fascism is the crackdown on freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. That's the real fascism. I want to draw attention now to an article in the world's leading liberal voice, apparently, The Guardian, formerly The Manchester Guardian, published here in the UK. Naomi Klein, a prominent Jewish American feminist liberal writer, has penned an op-ed, "We need an exodus from Zionism. This Passover, we don't need or want the false idol of Zionism. We want freedom from the project that commits genocide in our name." Now, that kind of thing is kryptonite, isn't it, to the lobby? That's precisely what they don't want to hear. It undermines all the bogus narratives. And what's more, it's becoming increasingly the position of enlightened Jewish people, particularly in America.
Right. And, you know, we know what's going to happen to them. It'll be like, you know, Larry Elder being called the black face of white
That's
supremacy.
Right.
They're going to have to keep relating to those double negative tropes and, you know, pretend that people like that don't exist. But they're all
Jewish
over the
face
place.
Of anti-Semitism. That's
exactly.
right. The Jew- she is literally the Jewish face of anti-Semitism. Finally, Brian, another couple of action-packed hours on State of the Nation, I'm sure. Who have you got lined up for our listeners tonight?
Oh, yes, we have a great show. I'm going to be there with Timothy Shea, and we're going to talk to Ryan Shaddix. We're going to talk to Joe Flynn. Tony Delgado, Ed Butowski is going to come talk to us about some financial stuff. Mark Anderson is going to join us, and we're going to talk about the WHO pandemic accord, get a big update on that. He's been on their Zoom calls, and they don't want to take they don't want to take his questions for some reason, maybe because next to his journalist you know, ticket, it says UK column. And we're also going to speak with David Grasso out of San Francisco. It's going to be fun. So stay tuned for State of the Nation. Thanks for having me, Basil.
Thank you. And finally, one quick question. I know it's always on your colleague Timothy's mind. Trump, is he going to get out of all this scot-free or not?
Timothy, I believe he would say, yes, it's going to be a show, but he's going to get out of it and he's going to be your next president here in the United States. I hope I'm speaking for him properly, but I think that's what he'll say.
Well, a lot of people have been saying that Biden is the lesser of two evils, but, you know, even that phony narrative is starting to fall apart. How can you possibly be the lesser of two evils if you not only endorse genocide, but then order your police to use rubber bullets and tear gas to break up a university protest, as is being the case at Emory University in Decatur, Georgia today, where the head of the philosophy department, an elderly lady, was also arrested for objecting to genocide in the home of free speech, the United States. I'll be back same time tomorrow. This is today's News Talk. Don't go away. More with State of the Nation after the headlines.